This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Wednesday, May the 8th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Political editor Pat Leahy has been very graciously manning the microphones in my absence last week. Thanks for that, Pat.
A real pleasure, Hugh.
I hope it was a pleasure for the listeners. I'm not sure. I'll have to listen back to see. I'm also delighted to welcome Ona Brin, the housing spokesperson for Sinn Féin.
Thanks for having me.
Ona, we wanted to bring you in because there's been a lot of talk about and writing about Sinn Féin over the last while. Interesting trends in the polls. Wanted to see what you thought about it. Pat had a big piece last weekend. Pat, maybe you could just give us an outline of what your analysis was of the party's situation first.
Do you want me to read out the whole thing?
Yeah,
that would take some time.
Yeah.
So what I was writing about, I suppose, is, I mean, to my mind, there's been two big trends in party political support since the last election. The first has been the rise of Sinn Féin, and the second has been the fall of Sinn Féin. Although, interestingly, the last couple of polls, including one at the weekend, there's a sign that the steady fall in support that we've seen for Sinn Féin since the second half of 2022 is abating or maybe coming back a little. So I guess that's one of the trends that we will watch over the coming weeks. And I was just poking around as to the reasons for that. I spoke to a number of people in the party about it, including Owen. And I suppose one of the questions I was trying to explore is to what extent that has got to do with the present focus on immigration, because we know that Sinn Féin has been under pressure on the ground. We know that Sinn Féin supporters, according to the polling, tend to have a harder line on immigration than is typical in the population at large. And so I'm not sure to what extent I was answering those questions, but I was certainly posing those questions in the piece.
I'm going to guess that you read Pat's piece, Owen.
I did, yes.
I wonder what you thought of his analysis.
There's bits I agree with and bits I disagree with, but I suppose let me take a step back. First of all, I take a great interest in polls. I study them very carefully. And there is a kind of a bit of a science to try and interpret the polls, because when you look at the macro numbers, that doesn't actually tell you why those numbers are changing. It just tells you where the numbers are going. And then beneath that, when you're looking at the subsamples, they're much smaller, the margins of error are larger. So whether a party over a trend period is rising or falling, the business then of interpreting why that party is rising and falling is less scientific than the overall analysis of the poll. So my sense of it is first of all, on the positive side, we have consistently polled above our general election percentage share since the general election. We have been ahead of every other political party and for most of the time by a significant margin. For any political party, that's a really good position to be in. It's also important to remember that there's a significant number of people who are undecided. They're excluded from the headline figures. Those people only make up their mind during the general election campaign and often the last week and a half. So that in some senses, the ups and downs are important, but keeping an eye on those undecideds and where they may or may not go is equally as important. That doesn't get much attention. I think it isn't the case, and I think the evidence isn't there to say the downward shift that had run from kind of midway, kind of autumn 2022, but particularly autumn 2023 into early this year, is solely or primarily about immigration. I don't believe the data supports that. But you'd be foolish to say that's not part of the political debate. That's not part of the mix. Pat is right. The most recent two or three polls have shown a trend back in the opposite direction. And I think one of the things that strikes me is what's quite unusual about our polling from mid-2022 till now is it's the first period of time where we're being attacked by everybody. Right? Mm. So typically, it would have been us versus government. But when you become the largest party, and when you become the largest party for such a sustained period of time, much, much longer, for example, than the Labour Party under Eamon Gilmore, if you remember, all of a sudden you become the pole of attraction from all sides. So obviously government focuses far more of its firepower on you. Other opposition parties do so. And of course, we would do the same if we were in their position. And obviously you have this small but very vocal emerging far right, which I'm sure we'll talk about. So in that sense, my read of the polls has been, I'm not surprised. And I also think because now we're out knocking doors, now we're talking to people with a level of intensity you wouldn't be outside elections. And what I'd be hoping to see, and again, we'll have to wait and see what happens between now and polling day, is that beginning of a trend moving back upwards will start to move between now and polling day, and we'll have an exceptionally good local election. But events always intervene, and it's like sport. You don't have the ball all of the time. There are times when your opposing team has the ball or plays better, or you don't play to your form. But where would I like to be 4 weeks out from a general election? I'd like to be the largest party. I'd like to be on an upward curve. That's where we are now before the locals and Europeans. And what happens there will play a large part in whether or not momentum is secured moving into a general election. So I think we're in a pretty healthy place.
Can I ask you, that's a very interesting analysis, and I particularly take that point about you being subject to attacks from both sides, perhaps in a way that you weren't previously. Going back 5 years, we're in a kind of Groundhog Day at the moment in a little bit. If you go back 5 years to the run-up to the last local and European elections, which were terrible, terrible for Sinn Féin, and inflected your approach to the general election that followed. And you were very central within all that, because the turn of the tide that happened in your own constituency of Dublin Midwest to replace Frances Fitzgerald when she won a European seat. And that was the first sign that very low ebb that you'd been in June 2019 shifted. And then just this remarkable upward curve to the by-election, to the general election, and then through to the polling, which showed a further boost up into the 30s. All of a sudden, there were three times as many people were defining themselves as Sinn Féin supporters who had done only a year previously. Presumably, that in itself creates certain kinds of challenges for Sinn Féin, for figuring out what that new electoral coalition is, who these people are, in the words of Kevin McAleer, who they are, where they come from, and where they're going. And that must continue to be a challenge, does it, with this very large new support base?
Yeah, although it's a challenge, certainly in Dublin Midwest, more generally, we relish. I mean, again, a couple of things to kind of pull out the strands. Local elections and general elections aren't the same. And polling generally looks at the kind of the general election polling question. Mm. So when I reflect back to where we were in the run-up to 2019, if I'd been on this podcast 6 weeks before the 2019 election, I wasn't going to be able to tell you that our percentage share of the vote in Dublin Midwest was going to collapse by 50%, a constituency where we thought we were well organised, we had good active councillors, you know, we had a TD who had a relatively high profile. But particularly in Dublin and Cork City, where our vote fell by half, we misread the strength of local independence, we misread the strength of our own local organisation. And a change that had happened in the party where previously, people liked to vote for the Shinners in the local elections because we worked damn hard on the ground. They were never sure about in a general election. That had changed quite a lot and we hadn't fully appreciated that. Other parts of the country, for example, in most rural constituencies, our vote fell by single digits, not double digits. And in a couple of constituencies, the vote held. So it was a mixed bag. But I think what we did correctly after 2019 was we didn't implode, we didn't navel gaze, we didn't start blaming each other. We sat down in a very professional way, asked ourselves.
But you did have, sorry to interrupt, but you did have at that point, I think, because I've written about this before, a fairly rigorous period of reflection.
So this is the point I was going to make, exactly,
and,
right?
And I wonder, have you had something similar in response to the fall in support since 22?
So the sentence I was about to make was we did a really good, constructive kind of critical review internally from all levels of the party. No holds were barred. Everybody got to say what they wanted. But more importantly, we then agreed a strategy which was about trying to reorientate the party, become much more positive, much more focused on what we would do if we were in a position to lead a government. But right up until the by-election, there was still a live debate inside the party as to what our percentage share in a general election was going to look like, because the poll numbers didn't recover. Right, and we thought we would gain some seats, lose some seats. We might have a net position of no change or marginal change. I think what changed in the by-election was the conversation was a different one, because once you got into the by-election, it was all about the government, not about who you wanted as your local councillor, kind of shouting your corner for your local area. And I remember being out in one of the first canvasses in that by-election. Like we went in to win it. We sat down. I was Mark Ward's director of elections. He was a councillor for us at the time. And we kind of devised this strategy where we thought if we could get our core vote out, by-elections generally have a depressed turnout, we're in the running, right? But we also knew if people thought we were too much in the running, that might increase the turnout. So we had a kind of a careful a balance to strike. Pat is right. A lot of, I think, the success is both organisationally in terms of the political messaging that we got right in that campaign and then the general election the following year was because of that internal review. And I think what we've learned from then is that review needs to be constant. So you constantly need to be reassessing that and doing it in a kind of a calm fashion, because when I see a couple of opinion polls going in the wrong direction, I don't panic. I don't think, okay, you know, there's a crisis here. You have to step back and kind of, in a very calm and reasoned manner, try and get a sense of it. But polls can always change. And the lesson of 2019 or the lesson of 2020 is they can change if you do something about them. And in that sense, I'm not sure we were ever at the heights that the poll of polls was averaging us out, I think 36% for halfway through 2022. I always thought that was an overestimation. I think the 33% that we were getting for a lot of 2023 was reflective of where we were. But sustaining that so far out from a general election, I think, is tough.
Where do you think those voters have gone?
So some of them, keep in mind, I always prefer to look at the core numbers, because actually the core numbers before you exclude the undecideds tell you a slightly different picture. So a lot of those voters hadn't gone anywhere. They were still in the undecided column, but then they were redistributed or excluded depending on the methodology. I also think there is a sense, and I get this both from looking at the polls, but also talking to people in Dublin Midwest. We canvass 3 times a week every week, whether there's an election or not. September last year, we started canvassing 9 times a week. We started doing 12 canvasses a week from February, and we're now doing 18 canvasses a week. I'm obviously not at all of those, but that's in the 3 local electoral areas. So we like to think we have a good read of the constituency. There was a very strong positive pro-change shift towards us during that general election in 2020. The people who came to us, a lot of them, it was this idea of change, of something different. A lot has happened since then. And a lot has happened to dent people's sense of optimism or sense that change is possible. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe we need to work harder to convince them. COVID has had an impact on that. The deepening housing crisis, you know, a couple of years back, we weren't talking to large numbers of young people who were considering emigrating or to their parents who were lamenting the fact that they'd gone. They were still in that sense that maybe something could change. So the first is that sense of hope for change, I think, has taken some knocks. And I think we have to work much harder to convince people that change is really possible. I do think COVID has had...
Just to jump in on that point and relate it back to what you were saying earlier, do you think that kind of some of the task for that faces the party now is to spell out in concrete terms exactly what that change means? Because it seems to me like there's a kind of a classic trajectory between elections where government support is often suppressed and opposition support is often kind of exaggerated. I'm not saying that those trends aren't real, but you do see that sort of a pattern. And often one of the reasons behind the opposition's falling away when you come towards a general election is that they haven't told people what they would do in government. To put it in very blunt terms, they haven't told people what that change would mean. And if you were talking about one of the lessons of the 2019 local elections as ingested by the party in that period before the general election was that you needed to be more positive and spell out what that would mean, I wonder if that's what we can expect from the party between now and the election.
So the first thing is, it is always a challenge when you spell out the detail. So I probably produced more legislation and more housing policy documents in my time as opposition housing spokesperson than any other opposition housing spokesperson. And there came a time where we'd be launching really detailed documents and nobody would cover them. Nobody, neither your publication or anybody else isn't. That's not a criticism. It's just you're competing for the news agenda. And turgid policy documents that spell out the detail of how you would do something don't often make it into the newspapers or television.
You need to make a policy document sexier, you know?
You can, and that's the kind of point I was going to make, which is sometimes you think you're spelling out the detail, you think you're publishing and outlining, but the way in which you're communicating just isn't getting through. It's not landing with people. So even though you think you have lots of alternatives, and I'm coming down with housing policy alternatives, it's always about to say, okay, so I think I've said a bunch of things that set out clearly how we deliver affordable homes or social homes or tackle Celtic Tiger era building defects or improve the planning system. That doesn't mean anybody's heard any of that. So the first thing is we have to get better at spelling out the alternatives we already have. I mean, David Cullinan published a really, really detailed policy document recently about reform of key aspects of the health system, particularly the waiting list systems there recently. Extensive engagement with people in the front line of the health sector at all levels, policy experts, others. When you looked at the news coverage the following day, bar maybe one small analysis piece in the Irish Times or the Irish Independent, most of it had nothing to do with health at all. So that means, first of all, we need to work out how do we communicate those alternatives better. I also think we need to do more in terms of spelling out not just what the alternative is, but how we would actually deliver it. I mean, I was going back to looking at what Fianna Fáil were saying in the run-up for the last general election. And it's bizarre because nobody was asking Fianna Fáil to spell out how they were going to do the things they were promising to do in their election manifesto. I remember Jack Horgan-Jones did a really, really good piece analysing Sinn Féin's housing alternative pre the last election. Very, very fair piece. He'd gone off and talked to industry. Some people thought our policies would work. Some people didn't. And it was a detailed analysis. Nobody, including this publication, did a similar analysis of Fianna Fáil, who were as untested at that point in terms of what they would do. So I do think we have to spell out some of that more. And then other issues intervene. So during COVID, for example, it became really hard to talk about housing. Right? One of the challenges at the moment, because obviously the way in which the government is handling, particularly the accommodation end of the provision of supports for people seeking international protection and recipients of temporary protection, is incredibly disjointed. So that means actually even talking about housing, it's harder. I spend all my day talking about housing. That doesn't necessarily mean people hear what I'm saying. So I think it's a mixture of doing what we were doing before, but better, spelling out in much more detail how we would deliver it, and then convincing people. And I go back to the point I made at the start, because opinion polls at the headline levels ignore the fact that a big bunch of people who remain undecided and ultimately get to decide the final shakeup of potential coalition, they only make their mind up during the course of the campaign. And many of those people only made up their mind in the final 2 weeks of the general election. So there's a lot of work we're doing at the minute. And I think that's part of the reason why the poll numbers are moving in the direction they are. I think there's an awful lot more work to be done as well. But I also say this. No opposition party that I know of has ever actually spelt out their actual plans from opposition. They publish manifestos, and manifestos are a bunch of high-level commitments and promises. But actually, in terms of plans, both myself, David Cullinan, and other frontbench people have and will continue over the coming period spell out in far greater detail than any opposition party has ever done how we think we can deliver the types of commitments we're going to make in our manifesto. And then ultimately, it's up to the voters to decide.
So then, in terms of your strategy, the party's strategy over the next slightly less than 12 months now, it's a two-lap race. We have elections in June, and then we have a general election to follow at some point over the following 8 or 9 months, I suppose it is. And interesting in what you were saying earlier about what happened 5 years ago, the local elections have their own particular dynamic. They tend to favour independents a little more than general elections do for obvious reasons. We see that independents are up in the polls. I mean, you referred to the far right, and there's a seems to be a constellation of micro parties over there on that side of the equation at the moment, and remains to be seen how well or how badly they do. But a lot of independents, I think it's fair to say, also nod towards some of those concerns and some of those issues as well. Do you see that as a threat?
Well, first of all, we need to be careful with how we talk about independents, because there's a wide group of people.
Sure.
So, for example, Catherine Connolly is an independent. John Collins is an independent. If I look at my own constituency, for example, there's a number of very locally based independents who don't have any ideological leanings, left, right or indifferent. They focus on the needs of certain neighbourhoods. And there's lots of those people out there. So that's part of the independent picture. Clearly then, within the independents, whether the rurals or the regionals, there's a mixed bag, and where they sit on the spectrum on issues, for example, of migration or, I suppose, social issues and socially conservative issues, there's a spectrum.
I'd say possibly the most left-wing people in Ireland are probably independents, and the most right-wing people in Ireland are probably independents.
And then there's a bunch of people who are independents who reflect a different set of kind of community-based values, and they tend to keep out of some of those bigger debates. That's my experience right across the country. So I think it's really, we need to be very careful when we look at what's happened with that independent vote, because depending on who's asked in the poll, the word independent means something different to them, right? So if you're in South Tipperary and your understanding of independent is Matty McGrath versus if you're in Galway and your understanding of independent is Catherine Connolly, you're not asking them the same question, even though they're giving an answer that can be interpreted in the same way.
Absolutely. But accepting that, I think you can also say that where there is resentment around issues of immigration and concern expressed perhaps in somewhat nativist ways, I think, Pat, you've made this point previously, the part of the political spectrum which is quickest to react to that, partly because it is a very grassroots sort of a politics, are the independents. And we have seen that around
the
country.
But let's be very clear, it's a portion of the independents.
Or some of the independents.
So I'm not disputing that, but it's a portion.
Obviously not the Catherine Connolly's.
And the only reason I'm making the distinction is because when the poll question is asked, people's interpretation of that word independent will really be determined by, well, what kind of independence do they have and do they vote for? That's the first thing. There's a more significant question, which is, obviously, one of the things that has changed in the last year and a half is what was a very, very small and fringe ideological far right that had operated in its own ecosystem and predominantly virtual ecosystem for quite some time, started to come outside the virtual world during COVID and has attempted to use the crisis around international protection and temporary protection to generate a wider following beyond their own ecosystem. I'm not seeing that shift in terms of political support.
So do you think it's overstated then or over-amplified?
I think we're not going to know until after the local elections is the first thing. But on the ground in the constituency I'm not hearing support for any of those small micro-parties or individual candidates who have clearly set out a kind of racist, nativist, xenophobic, anti-migrant message.
But is that because you have made efforts in your constituency and I know it's been the case out there to deal with through, you know, your own local organisation to deal with, negative reactions to the sighting of asylum seekers and refugees in parts of your constituency. But that hasn't been true elsewhere.
So it's a complicated picture. So I think before you answer that question, you have to take a step back. And, okay, so we're obviously having this discussion around that small, organised, ideological far right. And they exist, right? They have party political names, they have ways of operating, they have views of the world, whether it's the Great Reset, the replacement theory, the idea of immigration as some conspiratorial plantation, etc. Then there's a whole bunch of other people who are regular people. And when they experience a change in their community, the first reaction is discomfort. The first reaction is to ask questions, is to want answers. And my experience is very reasonable questions, which if answered reasonably, can allay a lot of those fears. So if we take Clondalkin, traditionally we had an international protection community of about 250 people in a direct provision centre right beside where I live. We now have an international protection community, men, women and children, and some temporary protection recipients of over 2,000 spread between Clondalkin Village and City West. That's a change, right? And we have to start by accepting that for folks who live in communities, that change, particularly when that change happens very quickly and without any dialogue at all, that can be disconcerting. And therefore, for me as a local political representative, the first thing is to go and to talk to people, is to listen to what they have to say, is to allow them to raise questions and concerns without being in any way judgmental. That's not say you soft pedal on racism or that, but it's to give people a space where they can talk about stuff. The second thing then is, the government has singularly failed, in my view, including in the constituency I represent, to communicate its plan, its strategy, its activity on these issues at all. I don't even mean they're communicating badly. I mean, no communication. So it's then left to people like me, and I'm more than happy to do it, to try and fill that vacuum and see, okay, so what are people saying? What are their views? What are their concerns? Are those concerns valid? And if they are, can we find ways of addressing them? Are they maybe less valid, but still worth responding to? And all of a sudden, you start to realise that the percentage of people who are motivated by an anti-migrant sentiment is really, really small. But there's an overlap, right? Because people are on social media and in WhatsApp groups. And, you know, when a far-right actor from another part of the country arrives in Clondalkin and records a video filled with disinformation outside a commercial building that's going to be used for international protection applicants and puts it online, that goes viral. So there's a job of work then, I suppose, inserting yourself between those bad faith actors who do not give a damn about the community that I represent and the wider questions people have. I think where that has become most challenging is when the government has made the biggest mess of the accommodation arrangements, right? And this is a tricky one because the government has never had a proper accommodation plan, either for direct provision before we had the recent increase in international protection applicants, never really put in place a coherent plan in terms of temporary protection recipients from Ukraine. Has always over-relied on the private commercial sector and private rental sector for direct provision, for homeless accommodation, for mainstream housing needs. And at a point in time, that over-reliance just kind of implodes. And that's the situation we're in at the minute. But my point is this, is that for me, that's a much bigger issue, which we're trying to talk through and think through. But in the absence of any meaningful government plan, the thing can get very, very messy. And that's what we've seen in a number of rural towns in particular.
And does that end up in a situation, a potentially dangerous situation, politically, pragmatically for Sinn Féin, where if the government isn't communicating and you're trying to communicate, that you become the target?
My experience in the constituency I'm in is that's not the case. And that would be the experience of...
It does seem to have been in other places, though. I mean, you do see at anti-migrant protests are, you know, at those protests which are... I suppose, as you would have described, people raising questions because they're unsure what happened. You do see a significant targeting of Sinn Féin at those.
But again, I would separate it out. So it's very clear that the small, vocal, ideological far right, and I'm making a very clear distinction between them and just regular people, they see us as their primary opponent because they're trying to get a foothold in working class communities. And therefore, strategically, you could see it at the rally at the weekend. They're more concerned about Sinn Féin than they are about the people who are in government and making a mess of not just the accommodation crisis for people seeking international protection and temporary protection, but the housing crisis, health crisis and other things. But more generally in the population, no. So, for example, very recently I was accosted by one of these individuals and given dogs abuse and it was recorded on a mobile phone and put up online. All I got overwhelmingly from people in the community, even from people who aren't voters of mine, were people saying that's not acceptable. You're an elected representative, you have a mandate, I have a reputation, I hope, for working hard on the ground. People can agree or disagree with what I do. So I wouldn't draw that conclusion. There's a group of people who don't like Sinn Féin, right? And that's no surprise. And they'll target us and that's fine. Our job is to talk to people, is to explain to people our position on these matters, explain to people how we would do things differently. I've been campaigning against this government and its predecessors' mishandling of direct provision since I've moved back down to the south in 2006. It has always been a mess and it's just got worse, right? Likewise in housing, likewise in healthcare. So for me, that's about the politics of engagement. I just think in some locations, the flashpoints have become so contested and toxic, it becomes very difficult to do that. All the more reason for the government to take a bit of a step back and look at how it's handling this, to work with other political parties and independents to try and find better ways of doing this. But that means government needs a plan. And what is patently clear is tonight, two groups of people will sleep rough on our streets. There will be, as there is every night, 80 to 100 homeless people. On the basis of the most recent estimates from the Canal, 80 plus people seeking international protection, sleeping rough on our streets. When our city is filled with vacant buildings, when our city is filled with vacant sites, when we have modular accommodation providers falling over themselves to offer government various forms of good, moderate and bad quality temporary accommodation, right? In a country that's one of the wealthiest countries in Europe. And how long have I been saying this? The Department of Housing won't talk to the Department of Children, won't talk to the Department of Health, completely uncoordinated. And the consequence, people are sleeping rough. Nobody should be sleeping rough on the streets of our city. And it is a failure of government to plan adequate quality emergency accommodation for folks who are homeless, adequate quality temporary accommodation for people who seek international protection, and then an adequate processing of people through those two systems to the other side. That's our core problem. And the more I talk to people on the doors, and the more we go through this with them, the overwhelming majority of people go, actually, do you know what? That's right.
So that's a very cogent and I think, you know, I would agree with it largely, criticism of the failure of government in this area. However, the government isn't in favour of open borders. Mm-hmm. And Pat refers to this in his piece. Why has Sinn Féin made a point in recent weeks of saying at the start of every statement on this issue that it's not in favour of open borders? Who is?
So first of all, it's not at the start of every statement.
I noticed about five or six weeks ago, suddenly it started to feature in every Sinn Féin statement.
So first of all, it's not at the start of every statement. But you're right, the party has made the point, and we've made the point for a very particular reason. There is a concerted online campaign by malign actors to suggest that the party's policy on international protection is something other than what it is. I'm not in favour of any deregulated regime, and I say this as somebody who proudly calls myself a left Republican. I'm in favour of properly regulated, compassionate, human rights compliant international protection regime. There's a bunch of people out there who every time I go onto my Facebook page, when I'm posting about housing or healthcare or whatever else, all they talk about is open borders, because what they're trying to do is convince Sinn Féin voters that we have a policy position which we don't have. So the party's trying to correct that. But what the party's also saying, and Mary Lou in her interviews with yourselves and others over the Christmas period, made it clear, first of all, we believe it is possible to have an international protection regime that is compassionate, that is fair, that is human rights compliant. We believe that should have an accommodation regime which isn't over-reliant on the private sector, commercial or private rental or hotel sector, but has state-funded, good quality owned-door accommodation. We've argued that for years. I've been advocating for the residents of the Direct Provision Centre in Towers to speed up processing times as long as I've been a councillor and a TD, because nobody benefits from slow processing times. One of the things people don't talk about enough, and again, I've been tracking this, and in fairness, the Irish Times has done good coverage of this. We've gone from having 800 people, men, women and children, in IPASS accommodation who have their leave to remain back in 2018 but can't get out because of the housing crisis to 6,500. If government had worked with us and listened to us and NGOs and others about putting in place a proper plan for those people, because they've got their status, they're legally entitled to reside in the country out of direct provision, we wouldn't have anybody sleeping on in a tent at the canal or at the IPASS centre in Mount Street. So my point is, we're saying all of these people, but if a small group of people are using social media to make a claim about our party that is not true, of course we're going to correct it. But we didn't use any language that we didn't use in our 2020 election manifesto, and we haven't in any way stepped away from the compassionate human rights-based approach we've always taken. But just like the government's making a mess of housing and healthcare and others, they're making a mess of this. And it is creating the space within which a small group of malign actors are trying to exploit a wider set of fears and concerns in society. And we're not going to allow them to do it.
One of the corollaries of an efficient system is that people who, and the majority of people who come here seeking international protection, don't qualify for it under the rules. And to have an efficient system, they are going to have to be deported or asked to leave or whatever. Do you have any discomfort as a left Republican, as you say? Do you have any discomfort with that?
No.
The idea of people being deported and sent back to where they came from.
If the system is as I would design it, which is it's compassionate, it's fair, it's human rights compliant, if people get the right to make their case to secure international protection, get to appeal that decision, and then get to apply for subsidiary protection if they're refused, if at the end of that process, if the process is done right, if they are refused international protection, then they don't get international protection. And my view, and
but
I've
the
no
process as
it
operates now takes, would you agree, takes too long?
Far too long. And the people who have been saying that the loudest, the longest, are the people in that process, right? Because what do people want? They want to come and hear their case heard. They want that process to be open and transparent. Far too often it's not. Far too often they submit documents, they hear nothing for a year or two, then a decision is made, then they appeal that decision. But be very clear, if you have a system that is compassionate, that is human rights compliant, that is fair and transparent, and if at the end of that process somebody is refused international protection, my view is they should be safely returned either to the
country
they came from or
the country of origin. Isn't the problem that the very length of time which that process takes at the moment is that there's a strong humanitarian case, even if somebody isn't successful, that it would be
and that has been the experience.
And,
right?
And in many cases, people apply for subsidiary protection, then that's granted, right? So, like, the system isn't as simple as some people think it is. But for the applicants, I mean, think about it for a second. If you are fleeing war or persecution, right? If you have gone through all of the trauma of getting here, if you are put into the direct provision centre, like I'm in and out of direct provision centres, I see the circumstances that people are left living in for very long periods of time. We had a famous case of a family in my own constituency who were from a country at war. They came here, they applied for international protection. They were in the system for about 6 years. They were a family of maybe five in a single hotel room, right, in a place that doesn't have much by way of facilities. And the husband died. And that family, that mother and her kids, were expected to stay in the same room, sleeping in the same bed until the decision was made. So of course the system should work efficiently. Of course it should work fairly. Obviously there are challenges, and what's happening in Britain at the moment is a challenge. But as somebody who is in favour of fair regulation, I'm not in favour of free movement of anything, right? I've always argued for regulation.
Except across the border, of course.
The border is in our country. And in my view, that isn't a border. That's the whole point, right? But that's a debate for another day. But you take, you know, for example, with the regulation of goods, of course we want a regulated regime, but it is properly, fairly regulated in the interest both of the host community and those people who are applying. But if international protection is to be what it's meant to be, acknowledgement and granting of international protection, if you are denied that, you shouldn't get international protection. That's the rules of the system.
Do you think that many people who are currently in the international protection system are in fact, economic migrants.
This is one of these things that I warn people against, right? And I say this because in my work as a constituency politician, in a constituency that has a direct provision centre for over 20 years, but also has a large migrant community that have come to Ireland through a different number of ways, it's really dangerous to generalise. It's really dangerous to say, well, all of the people from this country are something, mm-hmm. right? Each one of these families or single people are human beings. They have a backstory. There are complexity to their cases. And therefore, it's not for me to say if somebody is or isn't. We need a system that we have confidence in that will make the right decision.
Well, do you agree or disagree, therefore, with the government's move to expand the definition of safe countries?
I have no issue with the expansion of the definition of safe countries. People just need to understand that just because a country is safe doesn't mean it's safe for everybody. And therefore, there are arguments to say countries can define countries as predominantly safe. But within that, you can say, but for certain categories of people, right, either because of their ethnic minority, their religion, their sexual orientation, they're not safe. But again, I think that's why the system has to be fair. The system has to acknowledge that not all cases are the same. And again, I think what the vast majority of people want in that system and outside the system looking in is for it to work and work efficiently and fairly. And I think if it does that, we can have a much better system, one that works for the applicants, one that works for the taxpayer. And let's also remember, because again, I'm in a constituency that has a very, very significant migrant community, particularly in the Lucan side of it, but increasingly in Clondalkin. When I get the bus to the Dáil of a Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, and it passes the SIAC commercial building where the international protection folks are, they're all getting on the bus coming into work. Right? These aren't people hanging around on their 30 quid or whatever they get payment. These are people who, the moment they get the chance, they want to work, they want to better themselves, they want to contribute. Likewise, for example, you know, if I go out to Adamstown and I look at the folks who live out there, these are people who are keeping our health system afloat. They're keeping our IT tech sector afloat. They're contributing to all sectors of the economy. So we also need to have a conversation which recognises the government has made a mess of our international protection system, and I've no problem saying that. But also people who come to our country, just like Irish people, me included, who've gone to other countries to live and to work, sometimes at risk of breaking the rules, contribute enormously to our society. And therefore, you need to have that balance in the conversation. And I just see, unless you know somebody's backstory, you know why they're here and how they got here, you shouldn't be judging them one way or another. That's for the international protection system to make a decision.
I'm going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. We want to move on to a couple of other issues. One, you touched on housing briefly earlier, Owen. We ran a big feature on what the various, highly confusing to be honest, range of measures and schemes and incentives and what have you that the government has applied to the housing market, which I think the piece by Shauna Byers and Cliff Taylor estimated at being somewhere north of 8 billion per annum and probably more actually. How much would that change under a Sinn Féin-led government?
First of all, it's a very good piece. I think it's a very solid piece of analysis. And what it shows is not just the bewildering array of schemes, some of which have very, very significant budgets, but the fact that there's no coherence to them. There's no interrelationship with them. And I always make the point that housing is a system. And therefore, if the bits don't connect properly, the bits aren't going to work properly. And, you know, over €1 billion is spent annually on subsidies for social housing applicants to live in the private rental sector. We have an ever-growing range of schemes to subsidise private developers, from so-called Help to Buy, controversial shared equity loan, the Star Investment Initiative, LIHAF, etc. And when you step back and you ask, what are we getting for that? First of all, we're not getting a significant increase in the number of homes, particularly the number of homes for people to buy. We're not getting anything close to affordability. In fact, the very opposite, house prices are rising and new house price inflation is accelerating. And the government is subsidising elements of the housing system to an enormous degree, and sometimes celebrating that. So a lot of that is going to change, because our priority is going to be, in the first instance, delivering the largest volume of genuinely affordable homes for people to rent or buy, both social affordable rental, affordable purchase. And that means taking significant sums of money that are, in my view, poorly spent on a variety of badly designed schemes and redirecting that money into the delivery of those homes at prices that people can actually afford. And until we make that shift, that very, very significant shift from a kind of an ad hoc private developer, private investment fund led policy initiative or set of initiatives to something that kind of reinserts very, very large volumes of public homes. We've spoken about this on this podcast previously. We're not going to be able to shift the dial in terms of affordability. I mean, a simple fact, which people don't acknowledge enough. We've seen overall housing output between public and private sector increase over the last number of years. But the number of new homes being built to be sold into the private market has remained static. It was about 8,000 in 2019. It was 8,000 last year, slightly down in the year before. That means that the percentage of new homes that are going into private owner occupation is actually falling as a percentage of all homes. The
and
complete
that's
contrary
that's
of what
because
government
the
is
state
saying.
Is buying up an awful lot of the that this new private housing stock. Is that a contributory factor to that?
It's a couple of factors. So the first is that a lot of these government schemes, like so-called Help to Buy and the controversial shared equity loan, they were designed to increase output for the owner occupation market. They've abjectly failed to do that. Right. So whatever one thinks about them in terms of house price inflation, etc., primarily they were about stimulating increased supply. They haven't done that. The second thing is the largest volume of new homes last year of the 33,000 that were produced are going into the rental market and going into the rental market at very high prices. You're absolutely right. Of the 8,500 new built social homes, about 5,000 were bought as turnkey or design and build developments from private developers. Many of those would never have been built without those arrangements. The challenging factor, however, is they're all most all going into social housing, some going into cost rental. There needs to be greater balance in terms of affordable purchase as well as affordable rental. But I suppose that the overarching picture is it becoming more or less expensive to rent or buy a home in this state? Despite all of that money, despite all of the government subsidies, all of the data tells us, the RTB report the week before last, CSO Property Price Index for February, it is becoming increasingly more expensive. And the crazy thing is, and Michael McGrath was celebrating this, ECB interest rate hikes actually saw a fall in house prices in many other OECD countries. And here they continue to push upwards. And people thought about a year to 2 years ago, we were going to start seeing a moderation in house price inflation. You'll know from your own business pages when the last CSO Property Price Index was published, we're seeing an acceleration of new house price inflation. But also in those areas where nothing new has been built, particularly in the predominantly rural or suburban areas outside of the GDA, again, because people are being pushed further and further out from where they work with all of the consequences of that for long commutes. House prices, because people are chasing a very small supply of second-hand homes, are increasing. So absolutely, if you want to shift the system, if you want to move towards large volumes of genuinely affordable homes at prices people can afford, then you have to redirect a lot of that funding. Plus, you have to increase some of the funding into the types of things that deliver genuinely affordable homes.
So, Pat, it seems to me, you know, issues rise and fall, and we poll these questions, we look, and something, you know, health is always there, immigration has come onto the agenda. But time and again, the single biggest political issue in Ireland is housing. And I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you think it's going to be the nub of the debate in the run-up to the next general election, is it?
Yeah, I do. I think it'll be absolutely central to it. How much of a point of political division, though, it's going to be, I think, remains to be seen. I think the beginnings of how that debate is going to play out have become visible in the last while, and I'd be interested to know what Owen thinks of this, because it seems to me that the government will talk about its priority as home ownership and increasing home ownership, whereas Sinn Féin is more likely to talk about social and affordable housing.
So I disagree with the way Pat characterises it, because it seems to suggest that affordable housing isn't affordable housing that people can buy and own, which obviously it is. Here's the problem. And people who are trying to buy or have just bought homes know this better than the rest of us. Home ownership and purchasing a home has never been more difficult, right? Darragh O'Brien said the other day, you know, up to €100,000 worth of subsidies available to people through a variety of schemes. That's 25% of the price of a new build home in Dublin. And that somehow that's a good thing. What that actually does is not only saddles the purchaser with more debt than they probably can carry, but it also locks out an even greater number of people. So the government for sure will try and say this is about home ownership versus something else. The reality is this is about unaffordable homes versus affordable homes. So, for example, as we've set out in our alternative budget, we don't just want to build more social homes than have ever been built before. we want to fully integrate into a new model of public housing very, very large volumes of affordable rental and affordable purchase homes, and affordable purchase homes for singles and couples and gross incomes of 85,000 or less. That includes 80% of the working population between social, affordable rental and affordable purchase. The challenge is, how can you deliver those homes at prices that folks on gross incomes of 55, 65, 75 can actually afford? It is eminently doable. It's not because you're reducing the cost of delivering the home. It's you're dividing who pays for what in innovative ways to ensure affordability is locked into the system. And I actually think that's a debate that the government is going to struggle with. So, for example, in my own constituency in Dublin Midwest, the Clonburris Strategic Development Zone is currently under construction. Sinn Féin fought tooth and nail to get it across the line when Fine Gael opposed it and appealed it to An Bord Pleanála, 8,500 homes they were against, and Fianna Fáil abstained. But we have a government affordable housing scheme in Clonburris. And the purchaser of that home over two phases will pay €435,000 for that property. They'll pay €335,000 up front, and then whenever they have that mortgage paid off, they will have to pay the rest. In fact, the rest will be higher because it's an equity share, not a loan. And if they don't pay it, their kids who inherit the home will have to pay it at a future point in time. So in what world does a €435,000 home qualify as affordable? Look at the Land Development Agency, City West. They bought a bunch of apartments from Cairn, so-called affordable cost rental. €1,400 for a one bed, almost €1,800 for a three bed. That's more than the average cost of existing renters in that area, according to the Residential Tenancies Board. So I actually think the big debate is going to be who can deliver affordable homes. And that's a debate I relish because people know this government can't do it. Like they can see the cost of the thing that they're renting or buying or trying to rent or trying to buy. Our job is to convince them, and I'm confident we can do this, that on the basis of the models we're outlining, particularly with affordable purchase, where you separate land costs, site servicing and utilities from the price of the building of the home, and the state absorbs one and holds on to that in perpetuity, and the homeowner buys the other, you can start to deliver homes not just below €300,000, but €270,000, €260,000, right down to €250,000, depending on size, location, etc. That is eminently doable. The issue is it would take a level of direct state investment in those affordable homes that this government, like its predecessors, simply didn't want to do. And it's really interesting. Simon Harris comes out promising 250,000 new homes a year, has no notion what that means, right? Can't answer any questions. And Dara O'Brien is saying, well, actually, we haven't revised our targets with the ESRI and the department.
But they will.
We're not going to do that until the autumn, right? And even if they decide 250,000, which I think is the ballpark of what's needed, as do most of their independent commentators and experts, the issue is of that, how many are going to be genuinely affordable? How many are going to be available to working people? How many are going to go into social housing so that we start to see month on month, year on year reductions in homelessness, not increases, which we've seen under every single year for the last 12 years of Fine Gael in power and every year for the last 7 or 8 years with Fianna Fáil supporting them? I think that's going to be the debate. It's going to be, who does the public believe can deliver affordable homes at affordable prices on scale?
So I talked to somebody who's very sympathetic to that analysis which you gave and to the overall plan which you propose. But this person did suggest that Sinn Féin might have some challenges when putting together its manifesto in actually laying out the path that you go from the various schemes which are delineated in that article in the Irish Times a few days ago. You know, presumably you're not going to pull the plug on them overnight. There needs to be some kind of progressive descaling of them in some way and a transition to another. Can we expect that? And what kind of time frame are we talking about? Because one of the many problems with housing in over the last decade or more has been, you know, changes of policy, kind of headless chicken strategy, hasn't it?
So one of the biggest problems is the old bad stuff is left in place and then just new bad stuff is put on top. It's almost like a side section from Leaving Cert geography. You know, you see all of these kind of layers of rock formations over the years. None of it kind of connects. There is a challenge. So if you take the so-called Help to Buy scheme, right? And remember, that scheme was designed to stimulate the delivery of new homes into the owner-occupier market. And it has been singularly unsuccessful according to the government's own data. So the challenge is, do you end it in day one? Do you phase it out over a short period of time? What are the impacts, for example, on housing affordability, on supply chains? But also, in the Mazars report for the Department of Finance made this very clear when they recommended ending it within 2 years back in the report in 2022. They said it's also not just about what you stop doing, it's about what you start doing. And this goes back to the point I made around all of those different schemes that the government have don't relate to each other. So what we're doing at the moment is we're making decisions on the final shape of the manifesto in all of its parts. We're reviewing every single aspect of party policy, including housing policy, as we should, and updating it for changes in circumstances. For us, the crucial determinant will be what gets us to affordability at scale in the shortest period of time. And therefore, there's a discussion around some of these scales. But be very clear, these schemes have to be brought to an end. These schemes are bad for our housing system. The final decision, of course, will be made over the timelines for those. And that's how quickly can you ramp up the delivery of those affordable purchase homes that I mentioned? How quickly can you get people out of the private rental sector into good quality social homes, freeing up private rental stock for other uses? And what is the best way to ensure, in terms of your engagement with the private residential sector, you can assist them in activating, de-risking and reducing cost at the earlier phases of the development cycle, while at the same time ending those schemes that have had a really detrimental impact on our housing system? I mean, Kilman Queen, for example, who is no shinner, right? And he runs the very popular site Crazy House Prices. And he's somebody who understands how these schemes work, right? But he'll tell you, many of the people who avail of these schemes know ultimately they're being sold a pup because, yes, they're able to buy the home, but the house price is higher than it would have been and the mortgage repayments are higher. Or maybe they got help to buy, but actually the total volume of house price inflation was even higher and therefore it was more difficult for them to buy. But also remember, every percentage increase in house prices, and some of it is contributed by these government schemes, locks out another layer of people below.
Do you see any political danger, though, in working towards and actively seeking as a government falls in house prices in a country where there's still widespread home ownership across the population as a whole?
So a couple of things. First of all, second-hand house homes are cheaper than new homes, right? And all of our talk about reducing house prices is about new homes. We had this conversation after your interview with Mary Lou MacDonald over the Christmas period. And therefore, in the first instance, what we can directly control is the volume of affordable rental and affordable purchase homes, new homes coming onto the market through local authorities and approved housing bodies. They're the ones we want to bring down below the 300,000. On the private sector output, no government can control the price of private sector output in terms of what it rents or sells in the market. But when I talk to builders and developers, and I talk to them a lot, they keep saying, actually, they're concerned because the market, as their all-in development costs rise, the market for their product is getting smaller and smaller. So actually, they're looking for ways...
The developers are really concerned that house prices are going up.
But can I say this to you? The more homes you sell, the more profit that you'll make. If all in development costs are going up, there's a whole layer of house builders out there whose market is shrinking. But they have significant costs. They have risks when they buy land, when they attempt to get zoning, planning permission, the high cost of finance, the length of time it takes them to get on site. So rather than throwing subsidies at the end, which inflate house prices, what most sensible policy experts would advocate is find ways of de-risking the development cycle at the beginning, shortening the development times, getting people on-site building quicker, but you also then have to find ways to ensure the savings that are made, which aren't subsidies by the state, are passed on to the renter or buyer. But my point is, you can't say how much that's going to knock off the price, but it will moderate. And then the third thing is second-hand homes. We've never had a proposal for reducing the price of second-hand homes. They're in the market, they trade. But if we can get new affordable homes down below 300,000, if we can work with the private residential sector to moderate the price of new
homes... market impact.
That has an impact on new house prices. But let's be clear. I'm going to meet the Dublin Chamber of Commerce today. What are they going to tell us? House prices are killing industry and business in Dublin. Rents are killing industry and business in Dublin. The economy cannot sustain, let alone society, rising rents and house prices. We have to stop the rise, and particularly with the new stock, we have to bring it down.
Our clock is ticking. We've gone on for far too long already. Our producer has been...
That's not like us.
I know, but we do want to just finish at one point, looking ahead again on the basis of the current opinion polls towards the June election, the general election. We have a different kind of a landscape than what was envisaged maybe back in 2022 when the discussion was it would be a Sinn Féin government, either a Sinn Féin-led left government or perhaps a coalition with Fianna Fáil. We look towards a more fragmented political landscape, I think it's fair to say now.
Well, first of all, I've never shared your first analysis that a Sinn Féin-led government was the only option, because I was always of the view that other options were on the table. But you're right. Right now, things have become a little bit more fragmented. However, Irish voters are very sophisticated and they know when they go into the polls, particularly in the decideds, it's about government formation. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that some of that fragmentation starts to coalesce when people say, actually, who do we want to lead the government? Who do we want to tackle the big issues of housing, of healthcare, of childcare, of mental health, of immigration? Because I think at that point, people will start saying, can we really trust independents depending on who they are? Do we really want a terribly fragmented system like they had in Spain, where they had to have two and then a third general election in a very short period of time? Or do we want some stability? And I'm not predicting anything, but I think that's going to be the framing of the debate. And ultimately, it's going to come down to, on the basis of the current polls, there are only two parties that can lead the next government. One is Fine Gael and one is Sinn Féin. And if people want the status quo, they know what to do. But if they want something different, if they want change, they have a choice for the first time in the history of the state. That's a choice that they shouldn't waste.
Very finally, I did a piece the other day. You've seen Piers Doherty was in talking to our friends in Davy Stockbrokers. And they characterised, they had a session with them with investors in London and they did a note. And this was Davy's take on it. Now, it wasn't Piers saying this, but they characterised them as, characterised the Sinn Féin proposals for a government policy platform as more New Labour than Corbyn Labour. You were a fan of Jeremy back in the day.
I'm still a fan of Jeremy. And
were you offended by that? Full, or would you disagree
full,
with it?
Full declaration, I did a Davies event myself. Tony Blair built virtually no public homes and sought to privatise the NHS. The two core planks of Sinn Féin's policy going into this election is the largest public house building programme in the history of the state and proper universal, free at the point of access, public health care. You couldn't be more opposed to what Blair did, or indeed what Starmer is on those key issues. Of course we need investment, of course we need jobs, but people need public health care and affordable homes. And that's something neither Tony Blair nor, from what I'm seeing with Keir Starmer, intend to do.
You heard it here first. Sinn Féin, not a Blairite party. On that bombshell, we will leave it alone. Thanks very much, as always, for coming in. Thanks also to Pat and our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you very soon with the wrap of the week on Friday. Until then, thank you very much for listening.